Hello, I'm Paige, and this is the Euro Intelligence Podcast, covering current affairs in the EU and Euro area. I am joined by Wolfgang and Susanna, directors of Euro Intelligence in Oxford. Guys, the big story this week was the French regional elections and some surprising results. Susanna, you wrote about it this morning. Which narratives in French politics were turned on their heads this weekend?
Yes, it was a surprise, and it seems to be like polls do get it wrong ever so often in recent years, and regional elections this time is no exception. So what was surprising, the polls predicted Rassemblement National, this is Le Pen's party, to lead in 6 of the 13 regions. It turns out it only actually managed to be head on head with the Conservative Party, Les Républicains, in one region, and everything else just didn't manifest.
Whoops.
That was kind of a big bummer. Of course, Le Pen already has her narrative ready. It's all about lockdown, and people are still locked down in lockdown mode. And also the narrative is that her voters are not so keen on regional issues as they are on national issues. So she's preparing the narrative that in the end, it doesn't matter. And for our national elections, we will show up. However, what changed is the role that Les Républicains will play, because what we've seen is very strong performances of the party nationwide. They got a third of the vote. They got more percentage points in the vote than even last time in 2015. And the three heavyweight candidates really got an incredible large leap compared to the next candidate. So Xavier Bertrand, he's the biggest heavyweight amongst them in the region of Hauts-de-France. He got 20% ahead of Rassemblement National candidate. Now, this region is particularly important because Emmanuel Macron was sending in 5 of his ministers officially to combat Marine Le Pen, but also unofficially to challenge Bertrand in this region. Now, this strategy ended in a fiasco.
Yeah, another whoops.
Yes, they only got 8.5% in the region. So none of these, the narrative that he could challenge either Le Pen or Bertrand didn't work out so well. It was just turning against the marcheurs. For Macron personally, this is also a failure in a sense that he tried to make that link to the national elections. He really showed up in local venues, and subjects like security popped up, although none of the regional authorities have any say in that. So we saw an overlaying in the debates, at least on the campaign trail, and that actually might have turned off some people saying, well, we want to vote about regional issues, not about national issues. I don't know. But we don't really know what we can carry on forward into this national election campaign. It's only 10 months until presidential elections will take place. But we can say that the narratives for the candidates like Xavier Bertrand, but also for Valérie Pécresse or even Laurent Wauquiez, the former leader of Les Républicains, who scored a whopping 45% in his region, it puts them into a pole position to challenge that narrative that Macron will end up in Le Pen in the second round.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest maybe failures, not just for Macron, but maybe for all of the politicians involved in these regional elections, is the incredibly low turnout, the historic low turnout that we saw, the 68% abstention rate. What do you think? I mean, Le Pen is obviously using the narrative that people are still in lockdown mode, but I was out this weekend and that's definitely not the case. So how disenchanted do you think French voters are with their leaders right now, and how might this impact the coming presidential election campaign?
I don't think that you can actually extrapolate from that, because regional elections are regional. Mm-hmm. And I think they do make that difference between national and regional elections. I mean, I remember back then, the last elections, we had this huge debate about Boute Blanche. How do you account for abstention? How do you account for empty ballots? Is that a way of expressing your protest vote? Yes or no? And that debate might come up next time again. Wolfgang, you have very strong views on abstention and what it means and what it doesn't mean.
I'm less concerned about abstentions than most of the media people. I just generally think that they're meaningless. If people choose not to vote, then that's their choice. The question for us as analysts is to see, is there any pattern of the people who don't vote, as opposed to those who do? And, you know, if they turn up at the presidential elections, you know, those next 30 percentage points of voters who didn't turn up yesterday, but will turn up in April, whether they are different, the answer is we don't know. The question, the interesting question is on, and I debated it yesterday, is whether these carte blanche, these sort of official abstentions in a vote, whether they will actually help Macron or whether they will help Le Pen.
Exactly.
It's very hard to say that. I mean, there are scenarios in which either of those things can happen. For example, it is possible that people might want to express a vote of no confidence in Macron without supporting her by casting an empty ballot, but it could just put him into second, third place in that contest. And it might just in the end benefit her if she is second place and or first place. And if the second place candidate is from another party, likewise, it could damage her because it gives people an ability to express discontent with the president. Mm-hmm. Yet without supporting her, which I think was the original intention, wasn't it?
I mean, I know that there was a debate that it should count, but as far as I know, it's still the old way that you only count the percentage points according to those ballots. And therefore, your percentage of winning in the first round is defined by a relative share of votes that have been validated. And in that sense, it's a hypothetical debate. I mean, we had this debate whether the Gilets jaunes would manifest that way because they're not necessarily all kind of Le Pen supporters, or what do you want to do with them? This would imply a change in the election law. And I don't think it happened. I know that there was a debate, but I don't think it happened.
Well, in theory, it could affect the parliamentary elections. It cannot affect the presidential election because the first round is a relative contest, so the first two come through. And unless the abstentions make it to the first or second slot, which would be odd. So if unless they really achieve the majority, and then nobody is president, that would be really
odd. No one wants the political system.
Just finished with it.
Unless that happens, then the first two come through and then the final round is a contest. But it could matter for a parliamentary election, where you have relative MPs, etc. So that could shift ways. That would depend on the voting system, depend on how it's implemented.
It also could impact on the president's future mandate. If you have a significant abstention vote, it will, as a president of all of the French, you will have to take into account that. So I think moving forward, there will be some consideration in one way or another.
The only difficulty will be for the president to infer the right conclusions from that. The president is also the president of the non-voters, and it's hard for any president to understand what the non-vote is. Mm. In this case, the only message was be, yes, there are people who don't like me. that would probably be something that Macron would probably not take seriously, considering that, you know, hardly anyone likes him. People have very odd electoral systems. You know, there are all sorts of ways you can count votes. You have direct and indirect systems, and I have not seen the non-voters. That would be really new. You know, we've seen quite a few different systems, but it's ultimately someone has to win this. And you know, as Susanne said, we don't know. There's the local elections don't know. But what it does is, you know, all these people are expressing certainty and saying it will be this or this, and it's good for Macron, bad for Macron. I'm looking at the German elections where people have all, you know, the certainty 4 weeks ago that the Greens would win the election. Now they're certain that the Greens will lose the election.
Yeah.
And the correct answer is we just don't know. We have a campaign with 3 months. We do know the Greens had a bad start. And the CDU didn't really do anything. But it's the same as in France. The events that will determine the outcome lie before us. They have yet to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to say how noble it was that none of the mainstream media has run with the headline, a slap in the face, because I was really expecting that. It didn't happen.
Oh, no, I saw it. I saw it.
Did you? Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, they got him. See, that I wouldn't do that, but yeah.
No, you can, actually. I mean, why not leave it in? I mean,
It was.
I mean, if the media didn't do this, then just because they think they missed a trick. I mean, I don't think this is normal at all. The wrong guy was on staff last night.
Yikes. Okay. Switching gears now, Wolfgang, you wrote this morning about the failure of multilateralism and why this might be a good thing after a week of intensive summitry across Europe. Can you elaborate a little bit on why it might be good for multilateralism to be in a low point right now?
I mean, we've all written about this in you know, yes, all three of us in different stories over the last 10 days, mm-hmm, you know, the G7, NATO, various other summits. And, you know, what we have been observing for quite a long time is that, you know, you see two sort of strands of international politics. One is ad hoc multilateralism, and one is the stuff that's ingrained in international law, like maritime law, mm-hmm, and you know, human rights and various other aspects that are ingrained in law. And the same duality we have with the European Union. We have two strands in the EU. We have the stuff that's subject to majority voting, the single market, the customs union, the agricultural policy, the core activities of the EU that work in the time-honored manner, with the Commission, you know, proposing things, the Council, the EU Council, not the European Council, but the EU Council, the Council of Ministers, making the decisions, co-decisions together with the European Parliament, and then in some arbitration committees arriving at a conclusion. That stuff works pretty well. You may disagree with policies, but the EU is working well as an institutional setup. What isn't working well, both at the European and global level, is that sort of ad hoc multilateralism, where the leaders, the great guys, come together and save the world. And in, you know, the G7, they didn't save the world. They failed on vaccines for the poor countries. They failed on, as Gordon Brown was rightly saying, they failed to agree on special drawing rights. So there's an aid program for poorer countries. They really agreed nothing of any substance. And it's usually some fluff that's then hyped in the media. And the same in the European Council. I mean, we've been for years reporting on the euro area, the sovereign debt crisis. And it was all fluff that came from the European Council. The substance came from the ECB. We acknowledge that the recovery fund is not, you know, is of a different quality. We are skeptics, more skeptical than the media about it, because we think it's small. And because we think it's one-off, it's not a fiscal union, it's unlikely to be made permanent. But at least, yeah, it was a more substantive response. But the general progress towards European integration does not happen in those meetings. It happens through intergovernmental conferences, treaty change. And this process that is now underway, that has now started with this conference on the future of Europe, which at the moment is a very open-ended thing. It may or possibly may not lead to treaty change. But if it happens, so if there is, if you want to be optimistic about the future of the EU, that's what you want to need to be optimistic about. And if you're not optimistic about treaty change, then it's going to be very difficult. The multilateral process is not going to make up for it. And the same goes in the, you know, world with environmental policies. We will not achieve a solution to environment. I've written my column about this issue today in the, yeah, in the intelligence. It's the G7 won't save the planet, or even these various conferences that we don't have. What will ultimately save? Look in Germany, where the Constitutional Court suddenly implemented some of the climate targets. Now that's where suddenly these targets become part of the legal system. Mm-hmm. And that's how we achieve change. That's how we've always achieved change. It's a slow process. We won't do this, and necessarily we may not achieve that by 2030 or the target by 2050. The law works much slower than the media does. But we need very fundamental changes in the law to make progress.
But it seems to me that this is it's very similar in a peace process, right? Where peace agreements between leaders seem to be no longer doing the trick, and it's actually the bottom up approach that is needed in order for something to manifest. At least both of them are needed. And in terms of legal structures, there's this new movement about the rights of nature. That sees on local levels in America, but also some countries in Southern America, who gave specific legal rights to the entity of nature, arguing that if you, a little bit like children, the right of the child has to be preserved. And the problem is that in the legal structure, there is no such thing as the right of nature to persevere. If you take, for example, the Salt Lake in Utah, there is in a legal way, it's a vacuum, it has no right to have water. And yet it's so important to get the water from the streams. But what we see is that the waters has been used for new construction sites, new to expand the city, hardly any water comes into the lake. So how do you stop it? These are local questions that actually add up on a more bigger scale on a nation and questions. We saw Peru and Bolivia, including the rights of nature in the constitution. That's the next step. But you could go even further, that there is something international that needs to be done in order to really understand that the human-centric law as it is confined, that it is not the human-centric view that needs, it's the human-centric view that needs to sort of adapt to the reality that nature is, that we are a part of that nature.
Absolutely. And I think you touched on a really interesting point there about biodiversity as well, because that's something that is so often overlooked in all of the debates about emissions. And just looping it back to what you were saying, Wolfgang, I mean, the G7 has was not even able to agree on a phase out of coal at its meetings. The climate targets are such a long way off just for emissions, and biodiversity, I mean, hasn't really even featured in the conversation yet. So you can see just how long of a way we still have to go.
Indeed. I think it's much more likely that public pressure will make change. I mean, I saw an interesting announcement from Audi, the German car company, that jumped the gun on the ending of fuel-driven cars. They said they will no longer produce cars from 26, whereas the government was struggling, you know, with dates in the 2030s and 2040s to make this sort of compulsory. And there will come a time, and I would think that people would probably, you know, no longer want to drive these type of cars in 5 or 10 years. Whereas, you know, today the electronic car is still a luxury item, expensive item. But the, you know, as technologies change, as competition changes, as production technologies change, and point that I've made today in my column is that innovation will play a very important role, that most of the technology that will save the planet have yet to be invented. And the best we can do in that sort of aspect, encourage green entrepreneurship, you know, the best way, one of the best ways to do this is through reforms in the financial sector, because as always, it's the financial sector that ultimately determines the industrial sector. I mean, Germany has a corporatist industrial sector because it has like a corporatist banking system. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to, I mean, say if you were an opposition party and you wanted to really advocate radical change, that's where I would start. I would start with the banks. I would not start with the companies. And the same here. If you wanted to have a green entrepreneurship in Europe, you need a venture capital market. And that means you need an actually well-functioning capital market where people, you know, don't bring their money to the banks and the banks then do the rest. So you need a financial market that is much less intermediated than the ones we have today. So it's a broad-based issue. But what Susanne said about the shifts in definitions in international law and what I say about entrepreneurship, it's all has in common that it's not an action of multilateral politics. This is not an action of, you know, this administration and that administration coming together and agreeing. Obviously, administrations agree laws. That's for sure. Multilateral processes are partly about that. And, you know, large international climate conferences, to the extent that they produce legally robust targets, that would be, you know, that is a process. So we're not saying that all multilateral processes are bad, but it is the processes that are ultimately, that are bottom up, that involve parliaments, that involve, you know, because it's parliaments that make the laws, not Group of Seven meetings.
Absolutely. Well, that's it for us this week. Thanks for listening. Until next time.